Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakur coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
And that is the fact that the vast majority of fatal crashes involving children have been as a result of crashes with other vehicles.
New research reveals one in three deaths from e-scooters are children.
Said that their child or young person had been subjected to restrictive practices while at school.
Students with disabilities still face restraint, exclusion, and poor support in schools. And later today...
to do a two-day animation workshop, and this is targeting young people to try and get them interested or to have a feel of what the industry looks like.
The Africa Film Festival returns September 7 to the Sydney Opera House. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. A new study from the University of Melbourne reveals that one in three e-scooter fatalities in Australia involve children. Most of these deaths result from collisions with larger vehicles. I spoke with Associate Professor Milad Hangani, lead researcher, about the safety risks for children using e-scooters.
This data that we have gathered is the first insight into the exact risks of these devices. It has shown that disproportionately teenagers and children are being affected by e-scooter related crashes, and many children have unfortunately died on our roads as a result. What the data is showing us is that there is a divide and a difference between the patterns of fatal e-scooter crashes amongst adults and the patterns of fatal e-scooter crashes amongst teenagers and children. And that is the fact that the vast majority of fatal crashes involving children have been as a result of crashes with other vehicles, cars, youths, you name it. But in the case of adults, there's a split. Half of them are as a result of falls or collision with objects. Half of them are a result of collisions with other vehicles. This is suggesting that the unfamiliarity of a teenager with the traffic condition, with navigating the traffic, is a big risk factor when it comes to e-scooter riding. And that is something that needs to be taken into consideration, something that we're trying to raise awareness about.
And I guess, why do the current laws and regulations seem to fall short in keeping kids off public's roads with e-scooters at the moment?
Law and regulation is one thing, compliance is another thing. Currently, we have in most states a ban for children under the age of 16 to ride these scooters on public roads. And some other states like Queensland, the law is a little bit less clear. It says that under parental supervision, children are allowed, at least between the age of 12 and 16. However, it does not exactly specify what counts, what qualifies as parental supervision. Do the parent have to ride alongside them or just watch them from a distance? Both of them sound a little bit impractical, and it leaves the law in a murky territory, to be honest. In some other states, there is an outright ban, and there is variation across the states. Most of the states, however, do not allow children under the age of 16 to ride. However, what I have actually seen from the observations of teenagers riding e-scooters on TikTok is that a ban does not necessarily mean that no children will ever be on the e-scooter on a public road.
Yeah, and I guess e-scooters can be quite, appealing and practical. How has marketing by these companies towards children contributed to the use of these bikes despite, some restrictions in some states?
There is a complete and clear divide between the culture of e-scooting amongst adults who want these devices predominantly for commutes and for daily travel, and how they teenagers and children see them as devices that could sometimes be a sign of rebellion, a sign of being cool. There is gendered appeal to these devices. And these are the things that I'm learning by analyzing hundreds, literally hundreds and hundreds of TikTok videos where these devices are featured by Australian teenagers. And it's being shown that the marketing is actually working. It's being marketed to them on TikTok. Much of it is on display on TikTok. They learn from about the tricks and the appeal of e-scooters and e-bikes on TikTok. And the companies who sell e-scooters, in many cases illegal e-scooter devices, they know where to target teenagers. And much of it is on display on social media. And this is basically the biggest avenue where they can reach teenagers and they can appeal to them. And there are basically patterns of videos showing children even sharing with one another how to approach a parent to convince them to get them an e-bike or an e-scooter.
You just mentioned that, you know, kids encouraging their parents to buy these e-scooters. How can parents better, how can we better educate parents around these, the risk of e-scooters, considering they're the ones purchasing them?
That's a tricky question. I don't have a teenager myself. I only have a toddler, and I actually don't know how to go against her will sometimes, let alone a teenager. So it's the tricky part. However, what we're trying to do, we're trying to go beyond the anecdote and just being a safety alarmist and just put the evidence in quantitative terms to the parents and by extension, hopefully to the teenagers as well, so that they can have a dialogue based on the observations, based on the numbers, have something to have to give them a robust discussion of what the risks are.
That was Professor Milad Haghani from University of Melbourne speaking to The Wire. A new report shows students with disabilities in Australia are still being restrained, excluded, and not given proper support in schools. Nearly 2 years after the Disability Royal Commission's recommendations, we spoke with Children and Young People with Disability Australia CEO Skye Kazakowski-Moore about why this is still happening.
What we're seeing are classrooms that really lack the support, teachers that lack the support and the knowledge and the training that they need to support students with disability. We're also seeing the effects of really children with disability being segregated from their peers at a young age. We know that when children grow up, being exposed to diverse cohorts, learning alongside and playing alongside people that are different to them, that really increases the likelihood that they'll be more accepting and more responsive and more welcoming to children who are different to them.
In the report, it says only 39% of students were involved in their individual education planning, and most parents basically describe it ineffective. What needs to change in how we implement and approach individual education plans?
Individual education plans are such a crucial part of achieving proper inclusion and support for students at school. They're tools that are designed to be worked on in collaboration between a student and their parent and their teacher to identify what changes they might need to their schooling environment or to the curriculum to really help them get the most out of their education. To hear that a lot of students weren't involved in the development of their plan is really concerning. It goes against absolutely everything that we know about disability rights, and that's nothing about us without us. To hear as well that even when a plan has been developed, it hasn't been followed is incredibly concerning, because that lack of consistency is only setting students up for disappointment and for an even worse experience at school.
I know at the start you mentioned inclusive schools. The Queensland government recently announced new special schools, despite, you know, widespread calls for these inclusive schools. How does a decision like this impact the wider movement of inclusive schooling in Australia?
Well, we saw that when the Disability Royal Commission handed down its final report nearly 2 years ago, the commissioners with lived experience experience of disability really favoured a move away from segregated settings and towards a more inclusive environment. While additional investment in the education of students with disability is welcomed, we would rather see that investment put in place in mainstream schools so that students with disability are able to learn alongside their non-disabled peers, and that the teachers who are responsible for supporting those students can do so in a way that is really responsive to their needs, and helps teachers feel more confident when they are engaging a really diverse student cohort.
What action needs to be done, I guess, from the government moving forward?
First and foremost, what we really need is a national roadmap for inclusive education. This was one of the recommendations from the Disability Royal Commission, and what it would do is really set up a framework that would empower and require states and territories to ensure that they are funding their schools and setting up their schools so that we are able to achieve a truly inclusive education future for Australia. It's really hard to imagine what that could look like now, because the system is set up in such a way that segregation is entrenched, but through a national roadmap, we'll be able to see that consistency so that it wouldn't matter in what state or territory a child goes to school. They can be guaranteed that their local neighbourhood school will be a welcoming environment that will be able to meet their educational needs. Our survey of parents and caregivers revealed that nearly 30% said that their child or young person had been subjected to restrictive practices while at school. When we talk about restrictive practices, we mean things like being secluded, put in a room, removed from classrooms and separated from their peers, all the way through to things like being strapped to a wheelchair and that wheelchair being locked so the student isn't able to move around. Restrictive practices are incredibly damaging on a student's well-being and exacerbate the mental health concerns that we see many children, young people and families report to us. I think it's really important to note also that when we are talking about the bullying of students with disability, that bullying is leading to a mental health crisis amongst young people. We've had parents tell us that they are fearful for their children because their children are reporting concerns about self-harm and even suicidal ideation. So the need for action is urgent, and we would call on all governments, state, territory and federal, to take heed of the responses to this survey and really take some action now that it's been nearly 2 years since the Disability Royal Commission.
That was Children and Young People with Disability Australia CEO Skye Kazakowski-Moore speaking to The Wire. You're listening to The Wire, independent home affairs on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. Communities in rural and remote Australia are facing pharmacy workplace shortages, according to research coming out of Charles Darwin University. The fear is without enough pharmacists and pharmaceutical workers in these areas, the communities will suffer and struggle to get the necessary care. Former pharmacist and associate professor at Charles Darwin University, Dr. Heather Volk, is concerned states and territories aren't doing enough to recruit and retain pharmacists in regional Australia. The Wire's contributor from Tune FM, Ash Taylor, asked Associate Professor Volk how she got involved in studying pharmacy in rural areas.
So I think I came from a rural area myself, and so I had that background and understand some of the challenges of even just getting an education to gain the qualification to become a pharmacist was a challenge. And also too, I, at one stage in my career, owned a small rural pharmacy on the Queensland-New South border. So understand the difficulties around running a small business in those communities as well.
And I imagine there's a very different way of running a business in a rural and remote area in Australia. It's very different the way you interact with people there compared to the way you interact with someone in a metropolitan, in an urban environment. What were some of the challenges that you found while working there?
Well, in rural and remote areas, regional areas, you have to bring your full toolkit with you. You have a massive scope that you don't know what's going to walk in the door on the day. And so you have opportunities to grow and develop really quickly. But that can also be a negative in that's a bit scary for a young pharmacist going out in their first couple of years after having graduated. So, you know, it does allow for very quick career progression, though, because you are exposed to so many things that when you go back, you know, or if you go back to a metropolitan area, you've got a broader set of skills than a lot of other pharmacists would have.
I find that so many pharmacists here, that there's a social aspect to it that I never experienced when I was living in a bigger city. There was that genuine back and forth, you know, when you'd go in and talk to someone. Is that common, do you think?
I think it's based on a need. Often, you know, pharmacists are well trained to, you know, offer a whole range of services. So in the country environment, we have that opportunity to use those full skill set. But in communities, we often may not have a full-time GP or a regular GP. We may have a rotation through of GPs. So the one constant in that community is often the pharmacy staff. And that's support staff as well as the pharmacist. And because of that support and connectedness, they can follow people's health and build that trust relationship. That's really important for, you know, a lot of our role is empowering people to make informed decisions about their health and their medications. And so having that relationship allows that to grow and develop. You become so much more entrenched. And that's where we're really struggling with some of the funding for, you know, both community pharmacy and hospital pharmacy, that the way the funding models are set up, we're not truly recognising the cost of delivering those services in these rural and regional areas.
Why do you think it is that there is such a lack of funding for pharmacies in country and remote areas?
I think the funding models don't really understand the cost of delivering services. To get a pharmacist to a rural area, you have to bring a whole family. So you're looking for employment for other members of the family as well. You're looking at having education, housing, remuneration that's competitive with other parts of Australia, and also having, you know, like transport support systems so that people can go back to a metropolitan area for perhaps CPD, continuing professional development, or for to maintain connection with family as well. So the rural areas, it's not just a pharmacy issue, it's an underfunding of a lot of other things in the rural areas.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not just a matter of, oh, well, there's no pharmacist, they'll have to go to the next town over. There's actual wide-reaching impacts of not having access to this form of medical care. Yep. What are some of those impacts that you've seen in your research and in your own practice?
The first thing goes is all the add-on services. So a pharmacy can still supply, so you'll still receive your medications, but what you're going to miss out on is any counselling that goes with it, the pharmacist having time to look through to make sure that everything is safe and appropriate for you, you know, taking time to liaise with specialists and that, following up that your pathology has been done and that the medication is still safe and appropriate. So all those go if you haven't got the time, and we have supply. The next thing to go is supply, and that means then you're getting medications sent in from another area without any information that goes with them at all. And that then means that people don't have the information themselves to manage their own health. And that's where we really want to be, is that people can make those decisions for themselves.
Associate Professor at Charles Darwin University, Dr. Heather Volk there, speaking with Tune FM's Ash Taylor. The Africa Film Festival is back for a second time and it's showcasing more films reflecting the continent. On their first edition, the film festival was located at the multicultural suburb of Parramatta in Western Sydney. And this year, they'll be hosting the films at the iconic Sydney Opera House. The festival will also host workshops, a forum, and closing night party. The Wise Martin Davis spoke with Festival Director Esther Mumbi Inga about this year's event.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Unbelievable. I didn't even think we'd be mentioning that venue anytime soon, but here we are.
And in terms of this year's film festival, what's the theme of it? What's the intent of it?
this year is to empower African Australian filmmakers. That's our main highlight. Even though a majority of the films that we'll be screening are from outside Australia, and that is not because that's necessarily how we wanted it. It's because we cannot find local films because African Australians have stopped making films. And this is one thing that we're hoping through the festival, that we can work with the filmmakers and stakeholders to address. So, and because of that, we've got a few events besides the screening to try and encourage this, to try and address this. And one of those things is we've partnered with UTS, University of Technology Sydney, to do a two-day animation workshop. And this is targeting young people to try and get them interested or to have a feel of what the industry looks like. We had a survey. We reached out to filmmakers, African Australian filmmakers, to try and understand what the challenges are.
What is preventing young Australian African from making films?
One of the challenges is just lack of a network because, you know, we are still very young in this country. We don't have networks. And so I think eventually with time, people give up because you produce all this content, but you don't know where to go next from there. AFTAS are supporting this forum. They've sponsored it, Screen New South Wales, Screen Australia, and potentially SBS. To come in and have a conversation with these African-Australian filmmakers and, first of all, build the network, but people don't actually know where to look. So we hope to be a hub where at least we know once a year if African filmmakers are looking for some information.
And to an extent, is there also a little bit of the you can't be what you can't see? And so does your film festival help with that message as well to young African filmmakers here in Australia?
Yes, exactly. There was an article and they were talking about how underrepresented, they highlighted people with disabilities, Africans and Asians. And they were saying the Africans, only 1.4% of Africans are represented on screen, which is apparently way below what they target. And so when people are not seeing themselves on screen, then what you're saying is you cannot be what you can't see. You don't see yourselves on screen. So people think, well, this is not for us. There's no platform for us to tell our stories, to show our films. And so through this festival, we want to tell them, hey, there is somewhere where you can we can show your films, and we're going to try and bring an audience to see your films.
And away from appealing to the young filmmakers, what would anybody who can come along see at your film festival? What's the highlights at this, your second African film festival?
Yes, it's hard to pick which is your favorite child, isn't it? But what I will say is we've got a very powerful documentary called Sudan, Remember Us. And this is a film about Sudanese youth who are, I would say, creating resistance through poetry and music. And they're showing us how this resistance fueled a revolution in 2019. And the urgency of this film is actually amplified by today's reality. According to UNHCR, Sudan now has the highest number of displaced people in the world. I believe more than 10 million because of the ongoing conflict that has erased homes, communities, and future. And in Australia, this story carries even more weight because we are at a time where I understand the country is not really taking any new refugees from Africa. There is a very unique musical film called Nteregu from Guinea-Bissau. Guinea-Bissau is not a country that we hear about often, and it's just so beautiful to see how unique and diverse Africa can be. Maybe the third one I can say is Fanon, which is showing to be very popular this year. It's about Franz Fanon, a psychiatrist whose writing has been studied a lot, and it shaped liberation movements from Africa to the Caribbean, to perhaps even Aboriginal Australia.
Esther Mumbi Inga from Africa Film Festival there, speaking with The Wire's Martin Davis. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au. And follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where this program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.